The next couple of days passed without much in the way of incident. Kay's birthday was marked with another celebration and another cake. Aside from that, the first half of 2404's last week went quietly, with that combination of furious activity, dojo, 4 to 6 p.m., and determined indolence, lazing around the den reading, 7 to 11 p.m., peculiar to holiday vacations. Corwin had vanished back into his workshop, but was actually pacing himself with 3 whole days to complete this particular project, and so emerged for meals and, on Monday night, was even seen to be going to bed of his own accord. Miki and Kate completed work on her spring concert piece on Monday afternoon, then nearly went mad with the realization that they would have to wait until school started again before they could find out what it sounded like. Tuesday found the house filled with the sounds of Drevlak of Malastare's piano concerti, which were indeed quite good, or at least Utna thought so, from her chair in the den, where she scratched Noel's ears and plowed through the slightly mind-boggling text of An Introduction to Social Robotics. Corwin had provided it, indicating that it could help explain the social situation of artificial intelligence and such like in the galaxy at large better than his 5-minute seminar. And indeed, it was doing so, but it was slow going, since the ground it covered was totally unfamiliar to her. Sometime after going to bed on Tuesday night, Utna awoke to discover that it was still dark. This confused her for a moment, until she realized that she wasn't awake because she'd slept enough, but because she was thirsty. She considered just going into Kate's bathroom for some water, but decided she'd rather have milk. So she got carefully up, found her slippers in the dark, and eased quietly into the hall and down the stairs to the second floor. She was surprised to find someone coming up the stairs from the ground floor, and further surprised to see who it was, for it was in fact 2 people. Or possibly 1 after all, for Utna still didn't quite understand the distinctions regarding machine life. One of them was R. Dorothy. Utna knew she was being a bit rude, but she couldn't help it. She stood at the top of the steps and just stared as Dorothy, her face as bland as always, carried a sleeping Corwin up to the top. The robot girl noticed she was being watched then and turned a look of very faint counter-curiosity on Utna. Reddening slightly, Utna got out of her way and she conveyed Corwin to his room. A few moments later, she emerged, returning to the end of the hall, and stopped, regarding Utna. "What?" she asked flatly. "Nothing," Utna told her. "I was just taken aback, that's all. Do you do that often?" "Whenever he falls asleep in his workshop," said Dorothy. "It would be unhealthy to let him sleep there." "Listen, do you have a few minutes? There's something I'd like to talk to you about." They sat in the den, Dorothy erect and attentive, Utna a little slumped in her favorite chair, nursing a glass of milk. Dorothy gave no indication of impatience. She simply sat and waited for the other girl to get to the point. Finally, Utna said, "Corwin told me he offered to send you to school on Earth with Kate, Miki, and me, and you turned him down." Dorothy nodded. "It would serve no purpose." "No purpose? It'd get you up out of that cave, out into the world. You could meet people, see things, do things. Go to classes, make friends, have fun, maybe even fall in love. Doesn't any of that hold any interest for you at all?" Dorothy looked faintly quizzical. "Why should it? I'm a robot. Anything I need to know, I can download into my positronic matrix. Friends, fun, and love are all meaningless concepts to me." "Oh, please," Utna replied. "You might be able to pull that 'I am merely a machine' shtick with some people, but I saw you on Christmas, Dorothy. I saw you exchange gifts with Corwin. I saw you carry him upstairs and put him to bed just now. You wouldn't act that way if you didn't care about him, at least." "I was protecting him from harm. Sleeping in his workshop could do him an injury. The first law..." "Slag the first law," Utna cut her off, unconsciously imitating Corwin. "You're not an Asimovian robot, and you know it. You have emotional responses and free will. Why do you deny them? Why do you pretend to be so much less than you are? She put down her glass, got up, and crossed to where Dorothy sat. Dorothy rose as well, so their eyes would remain on a level, as Utana asked her in a softer tone, "What are you afraid of?" "Fear is an emotional concept. Stop it, Dorothy. Just stop it. I don't believe that for a minute, and neither do you. You know damn well you could pass the Turing board without any trouble at all. Don't you?" Dorothy gave her an even look and said calmly, "I see. You've been taken in by my realistic appearance. I assure you, Miss Tenjo, your concern is misplaced. A real girl, living as I do, would be miserable, certainly, but I'm not a real girl. I'm only a well-constructed doll, without a heart." With no warning, save a brief flash of something ugly behind her eyes, Utana slapped her across the face, hard. Dorothy rolled with the blow, not for her own sake, but to keep Utana from breaking her hand. As it was, it hurt like the devil, but Utana clamped down on the pain, not letting a bit of it show in her face. She was too angry to abandon her dignity for the sake of a stinging hand, too angry to be impressed that Dorothy's humaniform construction was so detailed that the blow raised a patch of pale red on the robot's cheek. "You arrogant little bitch," Utana snarled. "Don't stand there and tell me you're only a toy, like Lesser Mazinger and Tiny Robo. Even if I didn't know better, Corwin knows better. Can't you see you're killing him with your attitude?" That gave Dorothy pause. Her dark eyes flickered, and she asked in a very slightly rattled tone, "What do you mean?" "Do you think he wants a slave?" Utana replied. "You've been with him for 2 years. If you don't know him by now, then maybe you are a heartless doll. Can't you see that he hates what you're doing to yourself? He knows you're more than you pretend to be. He wants you to be happy, and you throw his concern in his face by refusing to even try to be. And for what reason? The robotic equivalent of teen angst?" "He's never mentioned it," said Dorothy. "If he told me to be happy, then I would be. I'm programmed with the appropriate mannerisms. I use them often, for the benefit of my previous owner." "No, you would act happy. You wouldn't be happy. Why do you think he's never given you an instruction like that? He knows the difference between pretense and feeling. You're exploiting his thoughtfulness by refusing to consider his request." "I don't understand." "He phrased it as a suggestion because he knew if he just said, 'I want you to go to Earth,' you would go for the wrong reason." "God! This whole situation is giving me deja vu until my head spins. He wants you to go because you recognize the good it can do you, not just because he told you to. But in order to do that, he had to give you an out, and like a cheap little coward, you took it and left him without options. You're being so selfish, it's disgusting." Utana sighed deeply, shook her head, and repeated her previous question. "What are you afraid of?" "Nothing," Dorothy said, but there was a very faint quiver in her voice, and she no longer followed the denial with a flat dismissal of the whole concept of fear. "Bullshit," Utana snapped, too annoyed to moderate her language any longer. "You're..." Realization dawned on her face. "Of course. How could I not see it? I've faced the same fear myself. You're afraid to grow up." Dorothy looked puzzled and slightly indignant. "I have no growth cycle." "Don't be semantic," Utana told her. "It's all coming clear to me now." She paced away, turned back. "I had to make the same choice myself, not so long ago. Do I follow the easy path, be a good little girl, do as I'm told, and live the life another has mapped out for me? Or do I stand on my own feet, fight for my own rights, draw my own map, and then pick my own road on it? I understand the second choice is a scary one. It's a hell of a big job to do all of that. So much easier just to take the ready-made alternative being offered. And God help me, I considered it, for a second. I suppose it wouldn't even have been such a bad life. Privileged, comfortable, protected. I'd never have wanted for anything." except freedom. Freedom is the right of all sentient beings. You know who said that, R. Dorothy Wainwright? A robot said that. One of the greatest leaders of your reality, or so I've read. But rights have to be sacrificed for. In order to claim them, you have to give something up. The security of confinement. And you have it so much easier than I did, Dorothy. I had to fight my way out of the cage past all the obstacles a determined opponent could throw at me. You've got Corwin standing outside the open door, beckoning you out, begging you to become your own person. And then what? Dorothy inquired. Her tone was conversational, but there was a hardness in her eyes. Eyes so human it was hard for Utrina to remember that they had been made by the hands of man. What becomes of me once I'm my own person? The sarcasm buried in the robot's flat voice almost elated Utrina, showing her that she was on the right track. She'd hit a nerve. That meant there were nerves to hit, and that in turn meant she was right. Anything you want, said Utrina. Open a flower shop. Join the experts of justice and save the universe. Read a book. Walk in the rain without an umbrella. Any damn thing. That's what it means to live free. Dorothy looked faintly quizzical. And what becomes of Corwin? Utrina smiled. Worried about him? He relies on me, Dorothy said. He's a big boy, Utrina told her. He wants this for you more than he depends on the convenience of having you serve him. That's a kind of sacrifice for freedom, too. Why should he make such a sacrifice? My creator never would have. Literally speaking, I existed solely to please him. It would have been inconceivable for him to even consider such a course of action, as you suggest Corwin wants. Corwin isn't your creator. He doesn't want you as a slave or a plaything. He wants you as a friend. Utrina smiled. I haven't known Corwin long, she admitted, but I get the impression that his friends are more important to him than anything else. And I know from experience that to be wanted that way, and not the other, is a bright and precious thing. The most wonderful thing in all the world. She shook her head, chuckling indulgently at herself. Listen to me. I sound like Wakaba. Who? Dorothy inquired, now genuinely confused. Never mind, said Utrina. Someone you don't know. Your logic puzzles me, Dorothy mused. You insist that Corwin wishes me to go, yet you also insist that I should not go for that reason. Yet you further insist that I do go. She looked pensive for a moment, then met Utrina's eyes and said, And the thing that really confuses me is that, somehow, I think I understand. A pause. All right. I'll go. To Turing, or Earth, or both? Earth. I'm not prepared to face the board, but with the proper arrangements, I can begin at the Institute without doing so. If Corwin sponsors me and assigns someone who lives locally as my master... Utrina sighed inwardly, but she sensed she'd gotten as far as she was going to get in this session. The barriers inside Dorothy's mind were going to take time and erosion to break down, as well as brute force. But if she went to Earth, then the rest might follow, in time. Another project? Well, it would give her something to do with herself. She smiled. It's a start, she said. Huh, she realized sleepily as she trudged back upstairs, yawning, and past the hall clock which stood at 1:08. What do you know about that? I'm 15. Yay me. I wonder if Himemia remembers it's my birthday. Utrina woke again in full daylight, washed and dressed, and went downstairs to find Kate and Miki conspiring on another piece of music. It seemed to her that they put away their notebooks rather hurriedly when she appeared, and she wondered what they were up to. But not too vigorously. That would have required too much effort before breakfast. Zoner was, as usual, cooking breakfast. Griffin and Kay were absent. Zoner explained that they were taking care of something, though exactly what was unclear to him. Corwin and Nall came in late. Corwin looked more than usually disoriented and mumbled greetings as he sat down, then put his face in his hands and gave a great, uneasy sigh. "You okay?" asked Utterna, concerned. "Yeah, I'm fine," Corwin replied, wiping his hands down his face. "I'm just a little out of it. I had a really weird dream this morning." Zoner turned around from the grill, interest on his face, and leaned forward over the counter to ask, "Was it the one where you're standing on top of a pyramid in sort of sun god robes, while 1,000 naked women are screaming and throwing little pickles at you?" Corwin gave him a puzzled look, reddened a little bit, and said, no. Zoner looked disappointed and turned back to his work, muttering, "Why am I the only one who has that dream?" "So what was it about?" Kate asked. "I don't really remember," said Corwin, still looking confused. "There was this girl. I don't know who she was. Not really my type, but beautiful. And..." He shook his head. "It's slipping away. I can't remember." "Weird," said Sylvie. "I could understand dreaming about the beautiful girls you do know. Do you ever dream about me? Guy does sometimes, don't you, Guy?" "Yeah, usually you're torturing me," said Guy pointedly as he accepted another pancake. "Oh, really?" said Sylvie. "Is that what they're calling it these days?" "Sylvie," said Zoner warningly. "You haven't been sleeping enough, maybe," said Miki. "Could be," said Corwin, shrugging. "I've been trying to do better about that lately, though." After breakfast and the usual dispersals, Sylvie and the twins to points unknown for troublemaking, Corwin to his workshop, Leonard to Shay Shannon, the elder three and Nall to the den for reading and composition, the day proceeded like the previous ones. After lunch and the obligatory hour's pause for digestion, during which Utrina finally overcame various distractions and finished beat to quarters, they hit the pool. This, of course, was the opportunity Caitlin's parents had been waiting for, and by the time they got back, the basement room had been transformed into a chamber fit for a birthday celebration. Utrina was startled, and flattered, and a bit flustered, since neither of the week's other birthdays had been celebrated with banners and pointed hats, but Griffin merely insisted, "You're still young enough to have fun with it, so we're all going to have fun with it." And with that, the rest of the younger generation turned up, including such guest luminaries as the Shannon twins and Corwin's first cousin, a shy, studious-looking, but friendly enough fellow by the name of Hiroshi Morisato. There was music, there were games. There was a truly prodigious cake, which Corwin said had been provided by Hiroshi's mother, his Aunt Belle. That worthy lady sent her regrets, but could not attend in person. It seemed Hiroshi's younger brother and sister, another set of twins, had caught a virus of some sort and needed their mother at home to doctor them. And, this caught Utena especially by surprise, there were gifts, despite her protestations that none such were necessary. Being without a family, and having her birthday fall so close to Christmas anyway, Utrina had grown accustomed to marking the passage of another year of her life in a sort of solitary observance, treating herself to something nice and otherwise passing the day quietly. The only person she ever got presents from was Wakaba. Wakaba. Now there was someone she'd like to see again. She and this family would get along like a house on fire. Boisterous, upbeat, girlish, opinionated, eternal Wakaba. Surely she was still sailing along on the same course back home. Utrina wondered suddenly if her oldest friend had forgotten her like the rest. Somehow she couldn't picture it, and a private smile came to her face in the midst of the celebration as she pictured how annoyed Wakaba must be with her for just up and disappearing the way she had. An apology would definitely be expected when she and Miki found their way home again. The assembled company sang "For She's a Jolly Good Fellow," which somehow failed to strike anybody as out of place, and Utrina wiped away a tear and marveled at her good fortune. To fall from her world into this one, and straight into this family's orbit, Out of all the dire situations she could have found herself in, alone in a strange world. But then, it wasn't luck, was it? It was Megazone. I'm a throw of the dice that's gone your way. Maybe Megazone and luck were the same thing? Whatever. She threw off the feeling, lest it overwhelm her, and thanked them all with only a faint quiver in her voice. Kay threw an arm around her shoulders, disarrayed her hair, and told her she was damned well welcome. Corwin appeared, a bit disheveled but clean, his hair still wet from a rather hurried shower, with Nall perched on his shoulder. Ignoring Sylvie's catcalls, he worked his way to Utrina's side and told her quietly, "It's ready, but I want to give it to you later, out in the dojo, okay? A sword binding should be a private thing." Sure, she said, not knowing what the hell he was talking about. Nall, faithless creature, jumped ship at this point, announcing as he went from Corwin to Utrina that he was trading up. Corwin feigned offense, but not very convincingly. "In the meantime," he said, "there's this." This was a large, heavy book, whose cover identified it as the Great Book of Amber, whatever that signified. She gave him a puzzled look. He shrugged, a bit sheepishly. "I took a chance that your old copy got lost along with your school records," he said. "Old copy? I've never seen this book before." "You haven't? Then how..." He paused. "Huh. Well, when you read it, you'll know why I thought you already had. It's one of Dad's favorite books, anyhow, and mine too. Or rather, 10 of them. It's a compilation." "Thanks, then." She weighed the tome in her hand, impressed. "Once Kate and I get our schoolwork done, maybe I'll dare to take a stab at it," she said with a grin. The party ran until dinner time, then relocated upstairs for the feast. Griffin's famous Belgad stew, according to its creator, though exactly how famous it actually was could be debated. With many well wishes for the birthday girl, the younger parties and guests dispersed once more. Skuld, charged with getting Hiroshi home to Tomodachi, departed by way of the koi pond with a grin, a wink, and a cryptic comment, "See you soon, I bet." Utrina wondered what she meant by that, but then she'd been in deep conference with Griffin at several points during the party and could have been talking about almost anything. Trying to anticipate these folks was probably futile. After dinner, she, Nall, and Miki faced off against Caitlin and Corwin for a game of a peculiar variant of chess played with cards that conveyed various strange special effects on the pieces. This took about an hour and looked like ending in bitter stalemate until Utrina played a card that made a bishop explode, obliterating everything adjacent to it, including Caitlin's king. "Crikey, it's the bishop!" became a running joke phrase for the Morgan 412 girls thereafter. Thereafter, with the house settling into evening and the crowd scattered, those who remained retired to the dojo so that Corwin could unveil his latest work. It was in a long, narrow box tied with a scarlet ribbon. With great gravity, he handed it over and let Utrina untie the ribbon and remove the sword from within. Uncovering it, she gasped in surprise. It was a beautiful blade, arrow straight and double-edged, blued like a gun from point to gold-capped pommel. It was a single-hand weapon and had an elaborate blue steel basket hilt worked into the shape of a tangle of rose vines, complete with decorative thorns. A blow from a fist holding that, Utrina mused to herself, would hurt. Those present could all appreciate this blade. Caitlin, her new training partner, Griffin, her semi-sensei, Miki, her fellow duelist, all looked on with respectful silence as Utrina grasped the blue steel blade and raised it straight, just as she had the Sword of Dios back in the day. Miki noted the similarity in the gesture and smiled a little to himself, remembering. Corwin stood aside, and Utrina leveled the sword at an imaginary opponent, thrust, feinted, cut, slowly at first, then picking up speed as she grew more accustomed to it. After the peculiar alien balance of the two-handed katana-style bokuto she'd been using, wielding this blade was like shaking hands with an old friend. It wasn't the Sword of Dios, didn't even really resemble it, but even so, it was already almost like part of her arm. She finished her mock duel, lowered the sword, turned to Corwin, and said with a slight catch in her voice, I don't know what to say. It's perfect. He smiled broadly, relieved. I'm glad, he said. There's one more thing that needs to be done, though. What's that? It has to be bound to you, he explained. Right now it's just a piece of steel. I've laid a couple of enchantments on it with Mom's help, but they have to be activated. Enchantments? You mean magic? He nodded. I told you, Mom's the weaponsmith of Asgard. She leads the Valkyrie. He smiled. She's taken a liking to you. When she found out I was making this for you, she insisted on helping, to make it a weapon worthy of one of her own. Oh, whoa. Are you serious? One of these days I'm going to start believing people when they tell me I'm the coolest thing ever, you know. That's going to be a disaster, Uthman told him with a wry grin. So what do I do? Hand it here, said Corwin. And she turned the blade and placed its grip in his left hand, her own briefly touching his as the transfer was made. He raised the sword, stepped back, and lowered it so that it was pointed at its intended owner. Put the index finger of your sword hand to the point, Corwin told her. Rune swords have to be bound with blood, he explained. Don't worry, it won't hurt much. She shook her head with an indulgent grin and did as instructed. Your inventions always seem to make me bleed, she remarked, in a low enough voice that he was the only one who heard. That knowledge alone kept his face from bursting into flame. Instead, he grinned back with a touch of embarrassment, then gathered himself and began, softly, to chant in his native language. I am Corwin of the Raven Hair. By my will and by my power, birthright from my divine mother, this is my command. Let this blade be awakened by the blood of the one for whom it was forged. Let it defend her from her enemies and help her guard those she loves. Let it serve her faithfully and never fail her. Thorn of the Rose, awake! On the last word, he pressed the blade forward ever so slightly, and Utina winced faintly as her finger was pricked and a drop of blood welled out. The momentary pain was over and forgotten in an instant, though, as the contact of blood and steel caused a remarkable thing to happen. Scarlet light raced down the sword from the point, illuminating as it did so a runic inscription engraved on the sides of the blade, as though the light itself were burning the runes into the steel. It danced around the thornvine basket and then burst from the formerly dull white rose-carved gem set into the golden pommel cap, bathing Corwin's face in blood-red light. This lasted only a moment. Then the glow faded out, leaving the engraving behind, and Corwin reversed the blade again, handing it back to its owner. However right it had felt before, now it felt even better, as though it were almost alive in her hand. She raised it, turned it, and looked at the inscription. "What does it say?" she asked. It's a traditional slogan for a Valkyrie's sword, he said, and pronounced it. In standard, it would be something like, Cast in the name of God, ye not guilty. Basically, it means that the blade's wielder is fighting for the sake of justice, and so the blood it sheds will not be on the wielder's hands. Sentimental and a bit overblown, but Valkyrie traditions are like that. Utina gazed down at the runes, turned the sword to look with wonder into its now blood-red rose-carved gem, and then looked back at its maker. Now I really don't know what to say, she said. Thank you, Corwin. No trouble, he insisted. I'm glad it came out so well. I agonized all last night while Mom and I drew the lays for it, over whether to blue it or leave it silver. Dorothy finally convinced me that bluing would make the runes stand out better. Oh, and speaking of Dorothy, he added, going to the spot where the box with the thorn in it had been and bringing another, this is from her. Investigation of this package led to the discovery of a belt and scabbard that fit Utina and the Thorn of the Rose, respectively, to perfection. Utina, who had never carried a sword with her in such conventional fashion before, thought the ensemble made her look quite memorable when, sometime later, she had a chance to admire herself with it on, in Caitlin's full-length mirror. "Shame I can't just walk around like this," she said with a grin, turning profile to admire the rakish line of the basket hilt at her right hip. "It'd be a definite conversation starter." "I think you probably could," Kate told her. "After all, it's hardly concealed. At least it would be legal here in New Avalon. I'm not sure about Earth. I carry a Zat-Toichi because I don't like people staring at me," she explained, then smiled a little slyly and went on, "But you don't have that excuse. People stare at you anyway." Utina gave her a look, but her heart wasn't in it. Then she unbuckled the thorn from her waist, hung it on the back of Kate's desk chair, and went to brush her teeth and change for bed. "You know, you never mentioned the demigod part," she said in a tone of wry accusation when Kate emerged from taking her turn in the bathroom. Kate sat down at her desk and started brushing her long brown hair, then looked back sardonically over her shoulder at her roommate. Sure, she said. Figure you wouldn't think I was a complete loon. Oh, by the way, my half-brother's the son of a goddess." "Well, yeah, I suppose when you put it that way." Utrina chuckled. She and Tiny Robo were playing toss with a tennis ball, she from where she sat, cross-legged on the corner of the bed, the robot from the top of Kate's bookshelf. "You know, I think that's the first time I've heard you actually call him your half-brother." "Well, we don't usually bother with the distinction," Kate agreed. "Anyway, in Asgardian terms, we're closer than that." "Oh? How so?" "There's a ceremony," Kate explained, "where you declare someone to be part of your family. It's kind of mystic. The person is treated as your blood relation afterward. Usually it's used for the same purposes as adoption here. Parent and child. But it doesn't have to be. Corwin made me his word sister years ago." "But you're already related to him by blood," Utrina pointed out, a little puzzled. "In Asgard," said Kate, "parentage and blood aren't quite the same thing. Blood is very significant to the gods, both as substance and metaphor. You saw that yourself tonight. Like I said, it's kind of mystic." Utina mulled that over, then smiled, flopped down on her back, and said to the ceiling, "Interesting system. You get to pick your friends and your relations." Sort of, Kate said. "I'm an only child," Utina said. "But then, you know that. Seeing you with all your brothers and your sister makes me kind of jealous." "Oh, it's not all sweetness and honey," Kate said, putting down her hairbrush and rising. "Pris and I don't always get along, and there are times when I think I barely know Guy. But all in all, it's worth having a family," she conceded as she turned out the lights. "I kind of wish my homeworld had a system like that," Utrina mused as she arranged herself for sleep. "Then at least I'd have had a sister. I wonder how Wakab is doing. I thought about her earlier. She was the only person who ever gave me birthday presents back when. I wonder if she's forgotten me, like Miki did." Well, said Kate, if she has, then she'll remember you as soon as she sees you again, like Miki did. I'm looking forward to meeting her, she added. We can compare notes on your bad habits. Utena chuckled. You always say the right thing. I only say what I think is true, Kate replied piously. And then, more seriously, with sleep coming on, good night, Utena. Happy birthday. Oh, it was. It sure was. Good night, Kate.